Miller's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Podcast pedagogy. What is Phil reading this week? Podcast pedagogy. Listening to teachers.
Naylor's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Naylor's Natter the Book. Ideas and advice from the collective wisdom of teachers. Naylor's Natter brings together a wealth of advice from the most influential voices in education today. In this exciting, one-of-a-kind book, Phil Naylor revisits the very best interviews from 3 years of education podcasting, drawing on the advice and opinions from some of the world's most innovative educators. Available now for pre-order from Amazon and out on July 7th, 2022.
A leader does need to say, that's not good enough. It's my advice to all leaders is write down as little as possible. And if there's too much fear in a workplace, it's utterly corrosive. And unfortunately, the source of fear, I think, is bad leadership or external forces such as Ofsted. It's about if you can remove fear from the workplace, make it fearless, then people will have greater capacity to get things done. It is about investing in relationships and positive human behaviour. It can't be fake though, Phil, it has to be real. But I think when you do that, you'll get the best out of people. I often say I wasn't the world's greatest leader. I've had some successes and I've had some failures and I've done some dead good things and I've done some stupid things. And the number of people who just expect improvements to happen, expect people to do their jobs, expect progress to be being made, and they just fill up the day with just getting through the day and getting to the end is absolutely extraordinary.
Talking to teachers about educational books, why we love them and how we use them in our classrooms. With guest authors, publishers, podcasters, and of course, teachers.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody. Welcome to the latest episode of Naylor's Natter, the podcast that's definitely more active in retirement than your average podcast. So I've got yet another exciting guest for you this evening, and I'm delighted to welcome Richard Vary to the podcast. Welcome, Richard.
Hello, Phil. Thank you for having me. Very excited.
Absolute pleasure. So we're going to be talking about leadership. So Richard's going to be talking about his book and his work in terms of leadership. And we're going to be talking particularly about fearless leadership tonight. So a nice, gentle introductory question, Richard, if we may, for our listeners. Just tell us a little bit about you and your journey in education to this point.
Right, Phil. I started school at 4 years old in a Catholic school, St. Joseph's in Norton. And I went to Catholic primary, Catholic secondary school, St. Michael's in Billingham, Catholic sixth form, St. Mary's in Middlesbrough. Then I tried out for the priesthood very briefly. There were some things about that I wasn't too keen on. Didn't last very long. Then I went to a Catholic teacher training college, Trinity and All Saints in Leeds. And then I went to, then I started teaching in 1989 in Catholic schools in Lancashire. And I've been here ever since. I retired from being a head teacher 18 months ago. I was in leadership for about 20 years. I was a head teacher for 14 years. And I loved it, but I spent the whole of my life from the age of 4 to the age of 56 in Catholic schools. And I've been out of it for about 18 months, but I've been working with schools. Old head teachers don't die, do they? They just become leadership consultants. That's what I am. About 20 years ago, I started a company called Fearless Leadership, who work in education, but also in industry. We've worked with a Premier League football team and the Welsh government and the Welsh NHS and some IT companies and construction companies using a model we call the Fearless Approach around leadership. Because what I found was when I started working with people outside of education, that the skills that we've got, school leaders, are very, very transferable, and the world of industry is desperate for them. So that's been really interesting. So currently I work with head teachers and dioceses and some businesses talking about leadership, and also working around the Catholic sector on, you know, the distinctive mission of the Catholic school. That's what I'm doing. I'm very happy.
Great stuff. Thank you. Okay, so like I said, the book we're going to talk about is going to be Fearless Leadership. And obviously, you've mentioned there about the other work that you do more widely on that. First question, we'll get into the book. So why is fear vital for survival but corrosive in the workplace?
Right, okay. So the brain predominantly has three parts, the triune brain theory. It's not mine. So it has, imagine these three parts of the prefrontal cortex, it's at the front of the top of the brain. It's a very young brain. It's only 100,000 years. It's the modern human brain, and it's great for creativity and thinking and problem solving and new stuff. And underneath that, the limbic system has loads of jobs. This is the ladybird simplified version of the brain, obviously. But one of the things it does is store information and things, you know. But another thing it does, it processes every sensory experience, everything that happens to you all the time. And if it senses something that looks dodgy, looks as if there could be danger attached, it sends that message to the reptilian complex at the bottom of the brain, the reptilian brain, if you want. And that reptilian brain is a really old part of the brain. It hasn't evolved for about 100 million years. So if the human brain's only 100,000 years old, the reptilian brain's 100 million years old. It's got much more experience. It's not as clever as the human brain. It only deals with three things, really. If there's fear, the reptilian brain will get your body ready to fight, run away, or freeze. So every time the limbic system senses fear, the reptilian brain gets put into action, and the human brain pretty much gets shut down. And the physical reaction to fear is then what the reptilian complex, you know, puts into place is a raising of cortisol levels, blood pressure rises, faster heartbeat, sweating, increased adrenaline, anger and aggression. And then what the reptile does to you is, right, shall we run away? Shall we fight or shall we freeze? Every time you're afraid. Now, it's been doing that to us and our ancestors for hundreds of millions of years. So when you're, this isn't a metaphor, it's true. When your ancestor was a lizard, it was afraid and it ran away from something. And it did that so that it could pass on genes to the next in the line. When your real ancestor, the mammal, was being chased by a predator, maybe it ran up a tree, maybe it ran away, maybe it froze, so the tiger, and managed to pass on their genes to the next one. And when our early human ancestors were attacked by rival groups or the rival hordes or whatever, they were able to fight back. So it's been really brilliant for most of the existence of us, of your genes or what was passed on. Fear has been absolutely vital. But the truth is, how often do you actually need to be afraid now? How often do you need to run away or freeze or fight now? You know, fear was really useful when we were in the jungle, but it's not much use in the office. It's not much use on the corridor or in a lesson or in a governor's meeting. And unfortunately, if the limbic system does feel threatened, does feel danger, it will cause you to become a reptile and not a human. And you see it at work all the time. You'll know people who are frozen. You know people who are at home because of anxiety or depression and the freezing. And you'll know people, you see people fighting on corridors and fighting in meetings and taking things personally. And generally that's because they've become afraid. Fear is a trigger. And if there's too much fear in a workplace, it's utterly corrosive. And unfortunately, the source of fear, I think, is bad leadership or external forces such as Ofsted anytime you're threatened. And if you are stressed, you know, you don't use your human brain, which problem solves and is creative and sorts things out. You tend to use the more aggressive brain, and you don't get good outcomes then. Stressed people are stupid people, literally, because the prefrontal cortex gets switched off during times of fear.
Okay, yes, brilliant. Thank you, Richard, for that. So in terms of, you know, so you as a leader going into a situation where you can feel there's a great deal of fear, what kind of things can you do in terms of that fearless leadership to lessen the impact of fear upon your team members?
Okay, I mean, the term fearless leadership was invented by my daughter when we were setting the company up. What should we call it? And it can be a bit misleading because it sounds like it's about, you know, feel the fear and do it anyway, or fearless leadership. you'd be able to put your head in a lion's mouth or whatever and be brave. And it's not about that. It's about if you can remove fear from the workplace, make it fearless, then people will have greater capacity to get things done. Do you remember Maslow that we all did at college? So I use a version of Maslow. We have survival needs at the bottom and then affection needs next and then affiliation up to achievement and self. And as a leader, I want everybody achieving, or I want them to have that sense of self that they're, you know, they're progressing to, for the sense of greater self-worth. But as you know, Maslow said that you can't move up until those other parts of the hierarchy are being fulfilled. So if somebody feels unsafe, they won't be able to achieve. If somebody feels unloved or disrespected, they won't be able to achieve. And if somebody feels like they don't fit in, they haven't got that sense of affiliation, they won't be able to achieve. So a bad boss makes screaming and shouting and pointing and not speaking and not communicating will make people feel unsafe, disrespected and unwelcome, and that will cause those fear reactions. A good boss will make people feel safe and will make them feel liked, loved if you want, it's a bit cheesy, but loved, respected, and that they belong. So they're real human things that good leaders do to tick those boxes, to fill those parts of Maslow so that people can concentrate. So primarily, I think good leadership is about normal human things like listening to people, respecting them, using good communication, using praise, smiling, giving people time, being accepting and encouraging and giving people chances. And so it's those kind of things. When you go into a situation where there's a sense of distrust or a sense of fear, it takes a bit of time and an investment in people and an investment in relationships before people will start to trust and relax. And then they're able to take risks. You know, as a leader, I want people to take risks, and to do that, they need to feel confident. And I want them to accept new challenges and new responsibilities, usually without extra pay. And I want them to go the extra mile. I want people to crawl over broken glass for me. And they're not going to do that until I've invested in them. Now, I know this all sounds a bit hippie-ish and the love you take is equal to the love you make. I do believe it. I mean, there's a hard underbelly to that about resilience skills and taking difficult decisions. But it is about investing in relationships and positive human behaviour. It can't be fake, though, Phil. It has to be real. But I think when you do that, you'll get the best out of people. I often say I wasn't the world's greatest leader. I've had some successes and I've had some failures and I've done some dead good things and I've done some stupid things. But when I look back, when I was doing a good, when things were going well, I was using these fearless skills. And when I wasn't doing well, it's because I wasn't. So I don't see the fearless approach as this panacea, but I just know that, you know, I was doing better when I was behaving in that emotionally intelligent way.
Thank you. Right, for the listeners' benefit now, this is the time where we have to be open and honest. So I've had the pleasure, listener, of working with Richard many years ago now, and I can obviously can reflect on the kind of things that he's talking about here and how he came into a situation and did use those fearless leader skills. And one of the things that I've admired about Richard for a long time is that teamwork, that togetherness. I vividly remember the first meeting that we had as an SLT. I can even tell you what picture we looked at, Richard, as well, if you really want me to go back that far.
It was the
workers on the end of the Empire State Building, I think it was, sat on the end of the piece of scaffolding, you know, in terms of trying to build that team of people there, the fearless. I think it was a fearless angle, wasn't it, on that one? But one of the things particularly about Richard Listener is that as well as those, you know, fulfilling those lower order needs, making people safe and secure and happy, and he's a brilliant communicator, he's also open and honest communication. And I think that's something that I've taken forward in a fledgling leadership career over the years in terms of the importance of that open and honest communication to go sit alongside that. So just tell us a little bit, Richard, if you don't mind, about, you know, your fearless approach to and the importance of open and honest communication.
Right. So the work I'm doing really at the moment with sort of executive coaching and head teacher wellbeing, the number of problems that you see where people just don't communicate is absolutely incredible. That community sounds so basic, open and honest communication, that if you don't tell people, it's as simple as this, if you don't tell people what you think or even what your judgment about how things need to get better, then it won't happen. So I don't know who was it who said, if it's not monitored, if it's not monitored or recognised or celebrated, it's not happening. And the number of people who just expect improvements to happen, expect people to do their jobs, expect progress to be being made, and they just fill up the day with just getting through the day and getting to the end is absolutely extraordinary. And I tend to think that, you know, if there's a blockage in communication, there's a blockage to quality. If you want something improving, you have to tell somebody about it. I think there's a huge blockage to quality with email. It drives me absolutely nuts. The midnight emailer, you know, who I chiefly would want to throttle, or the people who are conducting what they think is a discussion about some improvement that's needed through a disagreement through email, which is battered backwards and forwards, getting increasingly more nuts. My advice to all leaders is write down as little as possible. So I think in terms of open and honest communication, what it is that you want, and then just tell somebody. Now, I'm a coward. I would have to brace myself. I'd often write down what the difficult thing I was going to say and write that down and have it as my stiletto moment, not as a shoe stiletto, as a knife stiletto, and knowing that at some point in this meeting, I am going to say this. I don't really want to say it. On a personal level, it's not something I'd want to say, but on a professional level, it is. And I'd hope that my positive and fearless approach would make this more palatable. But I am going to say that difficult thing. And I think if you don't have open and honest communication, if you don't have that level of honesty, you really can't get any momentum in terms of moving forward and succeeding. But it's so hard because some people are just direct and bloody rude, and that's counterproductive as well. So it needs to be, you know, coupled with those positive skills.
Absolutely. But you must see that, though, and obviously you've alluded to it there in the work that you're doing with leaders, the idea that there's things that you can't say, and actually they then end up impacting on those lower order skills that we were talking about before. So that sense of belonging, the sense of trust, you know, that the belonging to the team, all of those kind of things. And
I
not...
think timing's an important thing. I've made some big mistakes in me in the past. So I know that I got into a mess early on as a head, really, by storing up a load of grievances against somebody that did my head in, you know, mm-hmm. and then blurting it all out in their performance management once a year, which became like a therapy thing for me and just made them cry. And I learned over time that performance management was basically a celebration of what they'd done and three things I'd like them to do next year. Did they get the pay rise? And that every day was the opportunity to encourage or point out weaknesses. A leader does need to say that's not good enough quite regularly, and that needs improvement. But if that seed of that's not good enough is going to be welcome, there has to be a huge level of trust and belief. Like, so I'm, you know, if people can't accept criticism, that's a huge blockage to quality because the improvements won't take place. But to get the right kind of culture where people are unafraid and can accept or even seek out criticism and want to do a better job, because everybody's not doing a brilliant job. And in your senior leadership team, you know, everybody knows the thing that you're rubbish at or the thing that you make mistakes about. And if we can get to a point where we're open and honest about that, we can improve. You know, you can get a real momentum of improvement when people are understand that this is what I'm not good at. This is how I need to improve. Can you help me with this? And asking advice. But it is that level. You've seen it, Phil. If you get an SLT and they don't trust each other, they don't like each other, they're in competition with them, it's a disaster. So that level of team where people are trusting and wanting to move on together, I think, is the key. And you can only get there if people are unafraid, and can only get there if people trust one another. And that trust is something that can be managed by the leader, I think.
Absolutely agree. And
I always say nearly every problem can be solved. There are some problems that really can't be solved, but anyway.
Well, we might get into those later on, but absolutely agree about the emails as well. And the listener will know that I've written a few times about the upside down world of email, and I am not a great fan of email, certainly not the midnight emailer. And like you said, the meaning can be lost, can't it, in the reception of it. And the one I'm writing about, Richard, at the moment is the CC. I cannot abide the CC'd email for accountability purposes. It's just say it. Just come and tell me. You don't have to, you know, passive-aggressive CC is the worst email.
I've worked with people. I think they set an alarm at 4 o'clock in the morning so they could send me an email. And am I supposed to go, oh, isn't it fantastic that you're working till this time? Or, oh, isn't it fantastic you've got this up this early? And no, all I think is, you're bonkers, you. You're absolutely nuts. You're not doing me any good at all. Generally, I think email is to clarify, you know, the time of a meeting, or more usefully, after a meeting, I would send an email that said, we've said this, you've agreed that you will do this by then, these two things, just so that there's some kind of trail and clarification. Because communication is really slippery. The number of times I've thought I've said, you know, nobody may stand on the grass outside the chapel, and then 10 minutes later, there's 60 kids on the grass outside the chapel because someone's heard me, in their head have heard me say, all children must go to the grass outside of the chapel immediately. That happened a lot. So email is a clarification of what you think you've said. And I know that often I've been miscommunicated because people have misunderstood me. And the third one, which is evil and sinister, but it is true, is sometimes you send an email just so that there's an evidence trail for some messy business further down the road, you know. But other than that, you know, it's a useless piece of, you know, people. I know some head teachers who genuinely believe their job is emails, and they've got thousands of them, you know. Anyway.
Well, we're getting slightly sidetracked because I've got you here, which is good, though, because, I mean, not to put words in your mouth, but I'm thinking that in terms of a leader, you were a very visible and present leader out and about on the corridors and speaking to people. Therefore, you didn't need to spend the time, particularly in the office, doing the emails, because a lot of the lower level, as all you said about those lower level needs, would have been fulfilled by... I mean, I remember you vividly popping into every classroom on a particular lesson. You'd come in, say good morning to everybody, you know, everyone would see you, and you get the chance to just have that little bit of a conversation with you just to make sure and check in. And it's really important, and it stops a lot of that need to communicate via other methods.
There was a couple of things about that. One was, it was a big school that we worked in, Phil, you know, there was a lot of kids there. And I'd worked in smaller schools where you could know every child's name, you know. And in the school of that, I was out to know every teacher's name. And I did want a visible presence, and I did want to model the way that I wanted my staff to talk to children. Because, sorry, you shouldn't say my staff, the staff to talk to children. And it had been a school where they had, but the kids were tough. And some of the staff were overly aggressive with the children. And that really wasn't helping discipline or behaviour in the school at all. So part of that was modelling the flavour of what I wanted and modelling the flavour of relationships I wanted between staff. Part of it was, visible presence. So the kids knew that there's a new head or the head teacher's about and cares for you. And partly it was, you'll understand this, is headship's really, really hard. And occasionally you'd be going nuts in your office and you just thought, I need to do something nice. I'm going to go and talk to the kids. But I did try and get out maybe once or twice a week in my diary. This hour, I'm going to go to every classroom and have a look around. And you do get to know dead quickly. I remember doing the walkabout, and you'd walk through, say, the English department, and your chest would be swollen with pride, and PE looks great, and that looks great. And then you get the maths department or the sound, whichever department it was, and it's rubbish, and all the utter feeling of dejection. So, you know, you did get that sense of what was going on in school. The walkabouts, they're good. Somebody told me, David Wells, speaker, and it's really good advice for heads, is don't just do rubbish stuff. Every day, do something that nurtures you and gives you strength and power. So don't just spend all the time with the difficult kids and the nutty parents and the grumpy teachers. Find some time to go and speak to those three kids who are absolutely brilliant, who you think are great, and always, you know, do some nice stuff. And then that really helped me. I always tried to do something nourishing for myself every day, very briefly. Yeah.
And in terms of the kind of flip side of that, open and honest communication is around the use of praise. And obviously you've been in a few schools that have been in what could be euphemistically described as challenging circumstances. And you've had a lot of work to do to try and turn that around. So in terms of your fearless leadership model, how effective is praise in improving the performance of any organisation?
So praise needs to be real, first of all. It can't be plastic. So you should only praise somebody for something that's true. Carol Dweck, the psychologist, says that praise should be for effort rather than for ability. You shouldn't tell someone you're dead good at that, because that just encourages people to lack resilience. We haven't got time to talk about the reason why, but you can buy the book and find out. But I mean, research shows that high stroke cultures where there's lots of praise, do better than cultures that don't get loads of praise. We know that from the Hart and Risley study in America, that the children of middle-class professionals have been praised six times more than they've been criticised, the children, and their outcomes are that become doctors and lawyers and teachers. The children of working-class parents have been praised, is it two or three times more than they've been criticised? And the children of parents on welfare in America in this study were found to be criticised twice as often as they were praised. And you see it, Phil, you see these people who just relentlessly criticise their children. By the time we get our kids in school, the ones who aren't going to do well, no, they're not going to do well, they've been told. And the ones who are going to fly have been told a million times how brilliant they are. And if it's true for kids, I think it's true for adults. If you praise somebody, they're more likely to repeat that behaviour and it'll give them a great sense of self-worth. I don't know where we got this idea from. It's a brilliant idea. So the PA at the school, wonderful woman called Helen Whittaker, we used to buy three cards. She used to buy them. I was the head teacher. I did very little. We'd buy three greetings cards. And then on a Friday, last thing we do on a Friday before we went home was we'd find three people to praise in the organisation. We'd thank this person for doing the D of E trip. That I'd called in your lesson. That looked really exciting the way you were doing that. Thank you for the difficult, you know, the way you handled that very difficult decision, the situation with these children or parents. And we'd send these three cards and I'd sign them and then we'd put a stamp on them and address them so that they'd be received on Saturday morning at breakfast time. Just three every week. Now, do you think that had some kind of positive impact? It's unbelievable, Phil. I had a woman who told me she used to lie awake at night asking, how on earth can I do something to get another card? There was a contest between two members of staff who both got six cards each. There were people who knocked on my door and said, how come I've never had a praise card? And it was because they were miserable. And people like praise. People like to be recognised and people like to live up to it. But it's got to be real. Can't be plastic. They reckon the ideal ratio, I don't know where this research comes from, is 2.7 positive to 1 negative. You have to do the negative, but it must be swamped in the positive. And when people are praised, they feel more positive, they feel more safe, they feel more like, they feel more welcome, and they're able to focus on achieving it and fulfilling themselves. I'm a really big believer in praise, as you know.
Absolutely, yeah. And I mean, in terms of it being genuine, that's the case as well. But there's so much to praise, isn't there? I've just realised, listener, by the way, while I've been talking to this, that you don't realise how much influence leaders have on you until you kind of step back and reflect a little bit. And I've just thought, and people who are listening to this, Emma, who was a guest last week, who's assistant head at our school, we go to every form every morning and say good morning to everybody. And then I have a few things, nice positive things to say. And I'm just getting a real flashback to Richard popping into my room in science back in about 2012, 2013. I think he got that's a long-lasting influence, but also that idea of praise. I mean, again, listener, not to overpraise Richard too much, but his assemblies were something to behold. And you know, in terms of, you know, these are the ones without the guitars, Richard. You know, this is the ones just with you speaking.
I never played the guitar in an assembly once.
Oh, listen, once.
That fear of the office thing. The David
free Brent love on the free worry. Love highway. Yeah,
where fearless leadership came from was we had this deputy head at All Hallows in Penwitham called John Allen. Totally brilliant bloke, very understated. And he made us all work dead hard. He was lovely, absolutely lovely, the loveliest man you could meet. Still a good personal friend still. when I became a deputy ed, I often used to think, what would John do? What would John do in this situation? And he used praise well, and he was encouraging, and he listened to you, and he let you take risks and didn't blame you when things went wrong, and was a joy to work for. But all of that team became head teachers. All of the generation of head teachers in Catholic schools came from him. So when I became a leader, I became a bit obsessed with how come this nice bloke had made us all work so hard. I really wanted to call the book Why Being Nice Works, and a publisher wouldn't let me because it was too cheesy. Being nice works, and we're all of us, the baton gets handed down in leadership of brilliant things that people have done and that you've learned from, and mistakes that people have, you know, made, and that things that you wouldn't do. And it is a privilege. It's a privileged job, but it's dead hard. I've only been out of it for 18 months, and I'm not sure I could go back and do it now, because I think I've been softened up by not living with that relentless pressure that you lot do all the time.
Well, indeed. But again, conversations like this, and this is why we do the podcast for the listeners' benefit, is because, you know, I'm getting some life coaching, some experience and everything from speaking to guests like yourselves and Richard. So it's brilliant.
Right.
Brilliant. Thank you, Richard. I really appreciate your time on a Monday evening in January. So just last question, if we might. Can you tell listeners a little bit more about your company, about Fearless Leadership, and a little bit more about where your book is available and how they can get in touch with you following on from the podcast?
Very good. Thank you, Phil. So our website is fearlessleadership.co.uk. If you want to get my contact details, you'll find them there very easily. Or just Google Richard Vary at Fearless Leadership, and I'm sure you'll get the details there. The book's available on Kindle and other ebook sources. The paper copy, the second edition of the paper copy, is just about to come out, but it might be a couple of months. I believe that Amazon are running a little bit short. Don't buy it on eBay. It's very tacky. Is that everything you need to know? I'd be happy to work with anybody who's interested. We've got the capacity to do that. We do executive coaching, head teacher wellbeing. I do some keynote speaking about leadership. And as well, I'm heavily involved in Catholic education through diocese about what makes Catholic schools distinctive, what's the mission of Catholic education. But I work in all sectors, open to all offers, as I say, Phil.
Absolutely. And of course, Nail is Natter, the book is available everywhere. Not that we're desperate to flog it or anything, listener, but you know, if you want to get it on eBay, I'm not too proud. Get yourself on it, wherever you want to get it on there. Somebody, please. Okay. Thank you again, Richard. Really uplifting conversation, and great to speak to you again tonight.
I've loved that. Thank you very much, Phil. That's been a lot of fun. Thank you.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nailers Netter, just talking to teachers.